supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Then, 11-year-old Tony Glover was an eyewitness to the presidential motorcade in Dallas when President John Kennedy was killed in 1963. With today's release of previously classified files pertaining to the assassination, now Dr. Glover, associate professor at the University of Scranton, joins me. Dr. Glover, welcome to NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you.
What brought you to the Dealey Plaza in Dallas on that day, November 22nd?
Actually, it was somewhat personal. My family was troubled, and I believed that at 11, if I could get Kennedy to look at me or wave at me, that would mean I was part of his, if not family, a friend, and that everything at my house that was wrong would stop immediately. And so I went with some magical thinking, you know, that it was going to help personally if I could get him to smile and wave at me. And he did, and it was incredible. We were at a presidential parade, people jumping up and down, talking to strangers, absolutely elated. And he turned the corner, and his head exploded. So we went from the highest joy you can imagine to just abject, you know, sadness over what happened within 10 seconds.
Did you try to make sense of this specific day in part by keeping up with all the subsequent news and reports about it? And here today with the release of previously classified files from the National Archives, are you interested in what they might reveal?
Actually, I have not kept up with things. I didn't come forward for about 30 years. And when I did, I was leaving Dallas. And I thought I should just go talk to a historian at the Sixth Floor Museum. And I did. And they pulled up a picture of me in Dealey Plaza. And it was the first time I'd ever seen a picture of me in Dealey Plaza. And it was stunning. You know, it was just something that you're not prepared to see. So I stayed away from everything. And when I came back and started talking about it, the historian said, you're in a bubble. You haven't seen all the stuff that's been produced since the assassination. Don't read it. Stay in the bubble. You're more valuable to us that way. So I really haven't kept up with it. I am trying to write my own book about it, just about witnesses and what they went through. And so I may stay in the bubble, even though this information's coming out now.
In the course of collecting these essays, does it either validate or give you different perspective on how you make sense of it?
I am very upfront about the fact that being there did not give me any insight into who killed the president, who did what. We were all at a parade. We were jumping. We were thrilled. We weren't looking for guns or puffs of smoke or any of that kind of thing. So some witnesses want to say, I know things about the assassination because I was there. I have the opposite feeling. I don't know anything about it. I was at a parade and then I was crushed by what happened.
We're speaking today, obviously, because it coincides with the release of previously classified files. And you've told me that 5 years back on the 50th anniversary of the assassination, you were sought out again for your reflections.
Yeah.
Tomorrow,
yeah.
Next week, next month, will you still be infused with thoughts about the Kennedy assassination or only when it is brought up to you?
Right now, I think about it a great deal because I am trying to write. When I take time off from writing, I don't think about it very much. Every now and then I will have a student come in who's just found the CNN interview that I did 5 years ago, and they want to talk about it. But most of the time, it's not the center of my life, certainly. Like I said, trying to write about it brings you back and brings you back to the immediate emotion, which is still quite a wound.
Dr. Glover, thank you so much for sharing recollections and very personal sentiments from that day.
Thank you.
Dr. Tony Glover, associate professor at the University of Scranton. The status of children whose parents bring them to the United States illegally has been a big focus of the Trump administration. On the one hand, you have Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, which the administration canceled this year, but might bring back if Congress does not pass a law making it permanent. That program only shields children whose parents brought them to the United States many years ago. So what about kids still coming, either alone or with parents or guardians? WHYY reporter Laura Benchoff joins me to talk about kids and their parents who end up at a detention center in Berks County and what the future might hold for others in their situation. Laura, take us to the Berks Family Residential Center.
So the Berks Family Residential Center, it's about 70 miles northwest of Philly, and it's one of three of these centers that ICE uses and has used to kind of contain families with kids who come to the U.S. illegally. So kids who come alone end up in other kinds of centers, but younger kids who come with a parent end up in family detention centers. It's just outside of Reading in a town called Leesport, and the county runs the center. They get jobs out of it, and it goes into their operating budget to run this center on behalf of the federal government. But they don't get to dictate how it's used. ICE uses this center, like I said, to contain families, but also in the past it has used it in a more punitive way to try to send a message to say, hey, don't come to this country. We're going to hold you for long periods of time if you come here and we don't think that you have a good reason to stay. Or even if you do have a reason to stay, we're going to hold you while you go through this long legal process to get the status that you might be eligible for.
So for those who are there for a more prolonged period of time, how does that play out?
Under the Obama administration, the center kind of shifted from being more of a processing place, you know, short-term stays, to much, much longer stays. And that has to do with, like I said, a message that the administration was trying to send to this large influx of families and unaccompanied children from Central America who started coming in around 2014.
Was that at the discretion of ICE to prolong those stays, or were there any legal mandates limiting the length of detention?
Well, this is what's complicated. The story I've been working on for several months with Reveal, which is also known as the Center for Investigative Reporting, just looked at this, the legal backdrop. On one side, ICE has a lot of power to determine what it wants to do with anyone who's coming into this country and seeking status, or anybody who crosses the border illegally. On the other hand, the U.S. has laws that deal with children. In general, we don't hold children accountable for the actions of their parents. So I followed one family in the center. It's a 34-year-old mother named Lorena and her 4-year-old son, Carlos. We changed their names because they're a little bit worried about talking about detention, feeling like there might be some kind of backlash. I go into this legal backdrop and I go into just what it's like for them to be there for a long period of time. So here's a clip from the beginning of that story. You're going to hear guest host Anna Sale, who's from WNYC Studios, and she's going to walk us through a hearing in an immigration court that this family had earlier this year.
In August, they went before an immigration judge in York, Pennsylvania.
All right, we're on the record.
Estamos en el test.
The court's audio recording is a little crackly.
Good afternoon.
Buenas tardes.
On the right side of the courtroom, a large flat-screen TV shows Lorena and Carlos sitting at a small white table. They're video conferenced in from a federal immigrant detention facility, about an hour's drive from where the judge sits. Carlos is 4 years old. His front teeth are missing, and he's got deep dimples. His head barely reaches the top of his chair. Judge Kumas Gopavar compliments Carlos for dressing up and for slicking down his hair.
You're looking good. I like the suit you're wearing.
The judge will decide whether to release Lorena and her son. The family's lawyer, Bridget Cambria, tells the court she's requested their release many times, but ICE always pushes back.
We are completely at the behest of ICE, and they have refused to release him for 650 days for no particular reason.
That's 650 days, nearly half of Carlos's life.
So what does ICE say about their request?
So ICE pushes back, and it makes sense from their perspective. They are tasked with trying to remove people as efficiently as possible from this country, and detention is just an important link in that chain for them. And this story is just about what that looks like. You know, if they're trying to expel people quickly and they use detention as a way to do that, what happens when the deportations aren't quick?
Of course, the much fuller story will be heard on Reveal this Sunday afternoon at 4 on WHYY. Can you tell us a bit more about what's in the Fuller report?
We had a cool opportunity at WHYY. We got some money along with Reveal from the Lenfest Foundation to try to make it more of a multimedia experience. So there are three stories in this episode. They all relate to the fringes of immigration policy. You know, we hear a lot about arrests and we hear a lot about protests, but we don't often see kind of these nuts and bolts of how the system works. And there's going to be this opportunity in different points to engage more with the content. So at a point in my story, I'll cue people to text a number and they'll get a picture, or I'll cue people to text a number and they'll get some numbers. You know, if you have a question about something you're hearing, you'll be able to actually get some more information and it'll be a little bit more participatory.
Thanks, Laura.
Thank you so much, Dave.
WHYY's Laura Benchoff on Newsworks Tonight. President Donald Trump announced today that he's declaring the opioid epidemic a nationwide public health emergency. For WHYY's Behavioral Health Desk, Joel Wolfram examines what this could mean for the Philadelphia region and how a mom in Bucks County who recently lost a son to an overdose is reacting to the news.
Jackie Redner's son Joshua died in September after a 10-year battle with opioids.
Losing my son to a heroin overdose probably could have been prevented if there was different types of treatment or more treatment.
Overdose deaths in Bucks County are up 65% so far this year. Jackie Redner says she's happy to see some action from the president, but thinks the declaration of a public health emergency doesn't go far enough. The president could have instead made a different kind of emergency declaration that would have immediately made money available through federal funds reserved for natural disasters, such as hurricanes or floods.
You're losing more Americans daily through this crisis than you are through a hurricane.
David T. Jones, the commissioner of Philadelphia's Department of Behavioral Health and Intellectual Disability Services, shares the same view.
The declaration of a public health emergency falls a bit short.
Officials are expecting as many as 1,200 people to die of overdoses in Philadelphia this year, eclipsing last year's count of 907. Some critics say that any emergency declaration is meaningless without focusing on expanding health care coverage for people who need addiction treatment. Scott Burris heads up the Public Health Law Center at Temple University.
What we need is a strong health care system, whether the current Affordable Care Act or some sensibly, you know, rebuilt version. We need drug treatment as part of that kind of health care system, and we need funds for drug treatment. We're not getting that. This won't get us that.
Burris says the president and Congress already have the power to shore up the health care system with or without an emergency declaration. For WHYY, Joel Wolfram.
Philadelphia's citywide public art experiment, the Monument Lab, invited 20 artists to create temporary public art pieces as contemporary monuments for the city. And that's just the half of it. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports the lab project also is designed to be a tool for collecting data.
During a recent unseasonably warm weekend in Philadelphia, hundreds of people strolled through Rittenhouse Square to take in the sun and notice some unusual pieces of public art. One is a pile of statue pedestals, just the pedestals, engraved with the names of women who probably should have statues. Another is a pair of viewfinders that impose historical photographs over the current view of the park. Researchers with clipboards were there to solicit reactions.
So Monument Lab, we're a public art and history project. We're in conjunction with the Mural Arts Program.
This is Rose Weinbaum, engaging a stranger in conversation.
If you had to pick a monument that would really represent contemporary Philadelphia, what would you choose?
What do you consider a monument?
This exchange is why Monument Lab exists. 2 years in the making, 20 artists making works in 10 city parks to make this conversation happen here.
The interface to this sort of research is actually the whole lab. It's the whole experience. It's, you know, people in public having conversations.
This is Lori Allen. She designed the data collection arm of Monument Lab, from the team of students soliciting the public to the resulting electronic database. She says it starts with a clipboard, a piece of paper, and a Sharpie. She was adamant that people do this in public, standing in a park, and not online.
We don't want people, like, alone in front of a computer to be the ones who decide what our public spaces should honor.
Allen made her job hard. It would be really easy for people to tick off multiple choice questions that could be seamlessly quantified, entered into a data set, and then crunched into a report. Instead, The proposal form is open-ended. There's a space to doodle, to rant, or dream.
A statue of a Pennsylvania woman named Edith Harbell. She was one of the very first muckrakers.
Vernica L. Wright. She was the first African-American female boxing promoter.
The rumble of the subway is the heartbeat of the city. It keeps Philadelphia alive. I really love the public transportation system.
Proposals range from the reverent, like statues of abolitionist Lucretia Mott or city planner Edmund Bacon, to the quirky, like a statue of a pretzel, a fist bump, or a sculpture of a brick, because, you know, bricks built this city. Monument Lab took this wild frontier of unedited ideas and handed them to Ursula Rucker. She's a Philadelphia poet who performs spoken word on stage and with bands like The Roots. Her job was to make sense of it all.
It was just, like, so overwhelming, you know, the amount of data. You know, so the data consisted of, like, you know, asking people what kind of monument to the city of Philadelphia could they dream of or would they think of, you know, and all of those ideas, little sketches.
We are our own monuments.
Rucker performed this poem, accompanied by a choir, as part of an audio monument designed by the artist Amike Ogbo on the roof of the Free Library in Logan Square.
The neighborhoods and the sections that change in an instant, from block to block, in an eye blink. These neighborhoods would be nothing without the people here, the soul and spirit of the people here. Not perfect. Nothing ever is.
Rucker discovered common threads in that stack of proposals, like neighborhoods, history, and unity. The poem, though, is not the culmination of the data collection project. In fact, none of those ideas will turn into an actual built monument. It's strictly research to take the temperature of the public and to think critically about what, who, and how we honor in public. Here's Lori Allen again.
For instance, you know, Julian Abel. Few people have proposed a monument to Julian Abel, who was the African-American architect who designed the Philadelphia Museum of Art. So sometimes people say, I want a monument, like, and it's very obvious that what they want is a statue. So they say, I want a statue. And other people say, I want a monument, something that represents. And we don't know that that is a statue.
Monument Lab in Philadelphia has inspired public art experiments in other cities, like in New Orleans, where four memorials of the Confederate Army were removed earlier this year. In reaction, a group of artists and scholars created paper monuments. Co-director Sue Mobley says it's modeled on Philadelphia's Monument Lab projects, but it's carried out in a much more charged environment.
They're not getting white supremacists showing up at their events, and we certainly are.
Mobley said the removal of those Confederate statues created an opportunity to not just put something else in their place, but to rethink how we remember history.
The act of leaving a pedestal that had a person on it supports the idea of valorizing and reifying a singular individual as what belongs on top of a pedestal. We need more representation of movements and collectives. There's still an instinct to say, well, but there's that one spot. So who's the person who should be on that one spot? And so breaking that.
In Philadelphia, the Monument Lab project is still collecting public ideas in city parks until November 19th. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
Next Tuesday, Catholics and Protestants take note of the 500th anniversary of the Reformation when the monk Martin Luther denounced Roman Catholicism. In advance of that, Temple University tomorrow will host an event entitled Transcending the Reformation, Counter-Reformation, a contemporary dialogue on the 500th anniversary of Luther's call for reform. The keynote address will be made by Leonard Swidler, professor of religion at Temple University and director of the school's Dialogue Institute. Professor Swidler, thanks for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
You're very welcome. Happy to be here.
Take us back to the 16th century and the importance of what Martin Luther intended to do.
Well, the beginning of the 16th century was a very lively time in Western Europe. This is when the scientific revolution is beginning to happen. Copernicus is a contemporary, you know, the guy who says, no, it's not that the sun goes around the earth, but the other way around. All of that sort of thing. Just a few years before that, of course, 1492, is when this whole North and South America was suddenly discovered by the rest of the world. And then maybe like less than 20 years after this 1517 beginning of the Reformation, Magellan goes around the world. And so, hey, guess what? The world's not flat, it's round. And from that time forward, it becomes a cascade of all kinds of changes. The scientific revolution, as I said, not only gets started, but it accelerates and explodes. The whole beginning of all the colonies, Western European colonies, for good or bad, this is when it all gets launched, and it goes like wildfire. And so in a way, you can see this period, the beginning of the 16th century, is like the start of a whole new era.
What were the major tenets of what he was railing against and for?
Actually, the whole thing got started because Martin Luther had a deep spiritual problem. He was worried, what can I do to be saved? This was a big question. They were thinking, you know, dying, going to heaven or hell. This was the really stark question. He says, by faith, by trusting in God, that's how we get saved. And, well, that was one of the watchwords by Scripture alone, sola scriptura in Latin. And similar thinking people at the time locked onto this only approach. So by faith alone, by Scripture alone, by Christ alone, are we going to be saved? In my talk tomorrow at Temple, it's going to talk about how things started and how it went from that seemingly wrong-headed decision, but a kind of whole series of dominoes began to fall. And what we have, in a way, is a transcending of all of the internecine blood that was shed. So now we have a world not only but partly, I would say, because of all of the fighting that we, in fact, see and experience. I think this is sort of like a last hurrah of much of this stuff. Dialogue, meaning I can't know everything about anything, certainly not the most complicated of all things in the world, namely religion. So I damn well better talk to somebody other than my own. Otherwise, I'm just going to be poking around in a very dark corner of the universe.
Professor Swidler, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
I'm very happy to be here, and thank you for the wonderful work you do here.
Leonard Swidler, professor of religion at Temple University and founder and director of the school's Dialogue Institute. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.